Chapter 14. The arrest was fast and efficient. It went down the usual way. Guns, shouting, handcuffs, Miranda. Reacher stayed silent throughout. He knew better than to speak. He had been a cop, and he knew the kind of trouble that talking can get a guy into, and the kind of delay it can cause. Say something, and the cops have to stop to write it down, and Reacher couldn't afford for anyone to stop. Not right then. The trip to the station house was mercifully short, not more than 4 blocks. Reacher guessed it made sense that an ex-cop like Franklin would pick an office location in the neighborhood he was accustomed to. He used the drive time to work on a strategy. He figured he would be taken straight to Emerson, which gave him a 50% chance of being put in a room with a bad guy. Or with a good guy. But he ended up 100% sure he was in a room with a bad guy because Emerson and Alex Roden were both there together. Reacher was hauled out of the squad car and hustled straight to Emerson's office. Emerson was behind the desk. Roden was in front of it. Can't say a word, Reacher thought, but this has got to be real fast. Then he thought, which one? Roden or Emerson? Roden was wearing a suit. Blue, summer weight, expensive. Maybe the same one as on Monday. Emerson was in shirt sleeves, playing with a pen, bouncing it off his blotter one end and the other. Get on with it, Reacher thought. You weren't so hard to find, Emerson said. Reacher said nothing. He was still handcuffed. Tell us about the night Alexandra Dupree was killed, Roden said. Reacher said nothing. Tell us how it felt, Emerson said, when her neck snapped. Reacher said nothing. The jury's going to hate you, Roden said. Reacher said, phone call. You want to lawyer up? Emerson said. Reacher said nothing. Who's your lawyer? Roden asked. Your daughter. Want us to call her? Emerson asked. Maybe. Or maybe Rosemary Barr instead. He watched their eyes. The sister? Roden said. You want us to call the sister? Emerson said. One of you knows she ain't going to answer, Reacher thought. Which one? Nothing in their eyes. Call Ann Yanny. From the TV? Roden said. Why her? I get a phone call, Reacher said. I don't have to explain anything. I say who, you dial the number. She'll be getting ready to go on the air. The local news is at 6 o'clock. So we'll wait. I've got all the time in the world. Which one of you knows that isn't true? He thought. They waited, but it turned out the wait wasn't long. Emerson placed the call to NBC and told Ann Yanny's assistant that the police department had arrested Jack Reacher and that Reacher was requesting Yanny's presence, reason unknown. It was a bizarre message, but Yanny was in Emerson's office less than 30 minutes later. She was a journalist on the scent of a story. She knew that network tomorrow was better than local today. How can I help? She asked. She had presence. She was a star in her market. And she was media. Both Emerson and Roden looked a little intimidated, not by her as an individual, but by what she represented. I'm sorry, Reacher said to her. I know you won't want to, and I know I said I would never tell, but under the circumstances you're going to have to confirm an alibi for me. No choice, I'm afraid. He glanced at her, saw her following his words, saw confusion cross her face. She had no reaction. He kept his eyes on hers. No reaction. Help me out here, girl, he thought. 1 second. 2 seconds. No reaction. Reacher held his breath. Get with the damn program, Yanny. 1 more second and it's all going to fall apart. No reaction. Then she nodded. She caught on. Reacher breathed out. Good call. Professional skill. She was a person accustomed to hearing breaking news in her earpiece and repeating it live on air half a second later like she had known about it all her life. What alibi? Emerson said. Yanny glanced at him, then at Roden. I thought this was about Jack Reacher. It is, Emerson said. But this is Joe Gordon. At least that's what he told me. He told you his name was Gordon. When I met him. Which was when? 2 days ago. You've been running his picture on your show. That was his picture? It looked nothing like him. The hair was totally different, no similarity at all. What alibi? For when? The night the girl was killed. That's what we're talking about here. Yanni said nothing. Roden said, Ma'am, if you know something, you need to tell us now. I'd rather not. Reacher smiled to himself. The way she said it absolutely guaranteed that Emerson and Roden were a minute away from begging to hear the story. She was standing there, blushing on command all the way up to her temples, her back straight, her blouse open, three buttons. She was a hell of an actress. Reacher figured maybe all news anchors were. It's a question of evidence, Emerson said. Obviously, but can't you just take my word?
For what?
That he didn't do it.
We need details, Roden said.
I have to think of my reputation.
Your statement won't be made public if we drop the charges.
Can you guarantee dropping the charges?
Not before we hear your statement, Emerson said.
So it's a catch-22, Yanni said.
I'm afraid it is.
Don't push too far, Reacher thought. We don't have time.
Yanni sighed, looked down at the floor, looked up, straight into Emerson's eyes, furious, embarrassed, magnificent.
We spent that night together.
You and Reacher?
Me and Joe Gordon,
Emerson pointed.
This man?
Yanni nodded.
That man.
All night?
Yes.
From when to when?
From about 11:40, when the news was over, until I got paged the next morning when you guys found the body.
Where were you?
Reacher closed his eyes, recalled the conversation the night before in the parking garage, the car window open an inch and a half.
Had he told her? The motor court. His room.
The clerk didn't say he saw you.
Of course the clerk didn't see me. I have to think about things like that.
Which room?
Had he told her? Room 8.
He didn't leave the room during the night?
No, he didn't.
Not at all?
No.
How can you be sure?
Yanni looked away.
Because we didn't actually sleep a wink.
The office went quiet.
Can you offer any corroboration?
Like what?
Yanni asked back.
Distinguishing marks? That I can't see right now, but that someone who has been in your position would have seen?
Oh, please.
It's the last question, Emerson said.
Yanni said nothing. Reacher recalled switching on the Mustang's dome light and lifting his shirt to reveal the tire iron. He moved his cuffed hands and laid them across his waistband.
Anything? Emerson said.
It's important, Roden said. He has a scar,
Yanni said, low down on his stomach.
A horrible big thing.
Emerson and Roden both turned and looked at Reacher. Reacher got to his feet, grabbed a fold of fabric in both hands and pulled his shirt out of his pants, lifted it.
Okay, Emerson said. What was that? Roden asked.
Part of a Marine sergeant's jawbone, Reacher said. The medics figured it must have weighed about 4 ounces. It was traveling at 5,000 feet per second away from the epicenter of a trinitrotoluene explosion, just surfing along on the pressure wave, until it hit me. He dropped his shirt back down, didn't try to tuck it in. The handcuffs would have made that difficult.
Satisfied now? Have you embarrassed the lady enough?
Emerson and Roden looked at each other.
One of you knows for sure I'm innocent, Reacher thought, and I don't care what the other one thinks.
Ms. Yanni will have to put it in writing, Emerson said.
You type it, I'll sign it,
Yanni said. Roden looked straight at Reacher.
Can you offer corroboration?
Like what?
Something along the lines of your scar, but relating to Ms. Yanni.
Reacher nodded.
Yes, I could.
But I won't, and if you ask again, I'll knock your teeth down your throat.
Silence in the office. Emerson dug in his pocket and found a handcuff key, turned suddenly, and tossed it underarm through the air. Reacher's hands were cuffed, but he was careful to lead with his right. He caught the key in his right palm and smiled.
Bell'Antonio been talking to you? He said.
Why did you give Ms. Yanni a false name? Emerson asked.
Maybe I didn't. Maybe Gordon is my real name.
He tossed the key back and stepped over and held his wrists out and waited for Emerson to unlock the cuffs. The Zec took the phone call 2 minutes later, a familiar voice, low and hurried.
It didn't work. He had an alibi.
For real?
Probably not, but we're not going to go there.
So what next?
Just sit tight. He can't be more than one step away now, in which case he'll be coming for you soon. So be locked and loaded and ready for him.
They didn't fight very hard, Ann Yanny said. Did they? She started the Mustang's engine before Reacher even got his door closed.
I didn't expect them to. The innocent one knows the case was weak, and the guilty one knows putting me back on the street takes me off the board about as fast as putting me in a cell right now.
Why?
Because they've got Rosemary Barr, and they know I'll go find her. So they'll be waiting for me, ready to rock and roll. I'll be dead before morning. That's the new plan. Cheaper than jail.
They drove straight back to Franklin's office and ran up the outside staircase and found Franklin sitting at his desk. The lights were off, and his face was bathed in the glow from his computer screen. He was staring at it blankly, like it was telling him nothing. Reacher broke the news about Rosemary Barr. Franklin went very still and glanced at the door, then the window.
We were right here.
Reacher nodded. Three of us. You, me, and Helen.
I didn't hear anything.
Me either.
They're really good. What are they going to do to her?
They're going to make her give evidence against her brother. Some kind of a made-up story.
Will they hurt her?
That depends on how fast she caves.
She's not going to cave, Yanny said.
Not in a million years. Don't you see that? She's totally dedicated to clearing her brother's name.
Then they're going to hurt her.
Where is she? Franklin asked Reacher. Best guess.
Wherever they are. But I don't know where that is.
She was in the upstairs living room, taped to a chair. The Zec was staring at her. He was fascinated by women. Once he had gone 27 years without seeing one. The penal battalion he had joined in 1943 had had a few, but they were a small minority, and they died fast. And then, after the great patriotic war had been won, his nightmare progress through the gulag had begun. In 1949, he had seen a woman peasant near the White Sea Canal. She was a stooped and bulky old crone 200 yards away in a beet field. Then nothing, until in 1976 he saw a nurse riding a troika sled through the frozen wastes of Siberia. He was a quarryman then. He had come up out of the hole with 100 other Zecs and was walking home in a long, ragged column down a long, straight road. The nurse's sled was approaching on another road that ran at right angles. The land was flat and featureless and covered with snow. The Zecs could see forever. They stood and watched the nurse drive a whole mile. Then they turned their heads as one as she passed through the crossroads and watched her through another mile. The guards denied them food that night as punishment for the unauthorized halt. 4 men died, but the Zec didn't.
Are you comfortable? He asked.
Rosemary Barr said nothing. The one called Chenko had returned her shoe. He had crouched in front of her and fitted it to her foot like a store clerk. Then he had backed away and sat down next to the one called Vladimir on the sofa. The one called Sokolov had stayed downstairs in a room full of surveillance equipment. The one called Linsky was pacing the room, white with pain. He had something wrong with his back.
When the Zec speaks, you should answer, the one called Vladimir said.
Rosemary looked away. She was afraid of Vladimir, more so than the others. Vladimir was huge, and he gave off an air of depravity, like a smell.
Does she understand her position? Linsky asked.
The Zec smiled at him, and Linsky smiled back. It was a private joke between them. Any claim to rights or humane treatment in the camps was always met with a question. Do you understand your position? The question was always followed by a statement. You don't have a position. You are nothing to the motherland. The first time Linsky had heard the question, he had been about to reply, but the Zec had hauled him away. By that point, the Zec had 18 years under his belt, and the intervention was uncharacteristic. But clearly he had felt something for the raw youngster. He had taken the kid under his wing. They had been together ever since, through a long succession of locations neither of them could name. Many books had been written about the Gulag, and documents had been discovered and maps had been made. But the irony was that those who had participated had no idea where they had been. Nobody had told them. A camp was a camp, with wire, huts, endless forest, endless tundra, endless work. What difference did a name make? Linsky had been a soldier and a thief. In the west of Europe, or in America, he would have served time. 2 years here, 3 years there. But during the Soviet, stealing was an ideological transgression. It showed an uneducated and antisocial preference for private property. Such a preference was answered with a swift and permanent removal from civilized society. In Linsky's case, the removal had lasted from 1963 until civilized society had collapsed and Gorbachev had emptied the Gulag.
"She understands her position," the Czech said. "And next comes acceptance."